Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook. My name is Justin Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. My goal for this podcast is to have world-class experts share their story along with their hard-earned insights. Often these people are so busy working, they don't have a chance to pass along their lessons learned. Hopefully you can take away some actionable advice and motivation to help you in your life and career. You can find additional content on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot or visit professionalsplaybook.com. My guest today is Lieutenant Colonel John Brick Caldwell. He's the commander and leader of the United States Air Force Thunderbirds. In addition to flying as the number one jet and leading all air demonstrations, he commands the 130-person squadron. He entered the Air Force in 2002 as a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy. He then completed pilot training in 2005, where he swept all the awards, winning the Red Riveret Trophy, the AETC Top Air-to-Air Student Award, and the Top Graduate Honor. He is also a graduate of the USAF Weapons School and has logged over 2,400 hours of flight time, with more than 660 of those in combat. Here's a brief highlight from our conversation today.
It's very difficult to do it right. Your brain is just not trained when you show up to this squadron to do that instinctively. You have to develop the muscle memory and the habit patterns. And the flying is incredibly unforgiving. I mean, if I'm in, even in a reposition, if I'm even a 0.1 G's different, or if I maneuver, you know, and I have a 0.1 change, the guys will sense it and they'll know it. So I have to fly almost like a robot. It's very smooth, very methodical, you know, and you got guys 18 inches off your wing, not just straight and level, but in the vertical rolling loops, clover loops. They're right there 18 inches off your wing as you're transitioning through wind shear, turbulence, everything else. So flying that smoothly and that precisely is incredibly difficult, incredibly challenging. But at the end of the day, I really do enjoy the challenge.
I learned a lot from Brick today. He is a consummate fighter pilot. He is both a warrior and ambassador for the Air Force. In this episode, we talk about where he got his passion for aviation, the lessons he learned from deploying to both Iraq and Afghanistan, losing a fellow pilot in combat, the mission he won a distinguished flying cross on, his experience in the test squadron flying with the newest updates to the F-16, his decision to join the Thunderbirds, how they debrief, and what he's looking forward to most this year. Now, without further ado, Brick Caldwell.
Brick, sir, what's going on? Thanks for being on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Just another day out here at Nellis. It's a little bit windy, but we just got done doing a training mission, and we're on the day before the squadron goes on a spring break, so spirits are high, and I'm happy to be able to chat with you here.
Very nice. So let's turn back the clock a little bit. Where did you first get your passion for aviation?
Growing up, definitely, I've always been interested in aviation. I think a lot of it was probably influenced by media and culture at the time. So Top Gun, I hate to say it, but Iron Eagle, all those, very nice. Those movies were impressionable to me as a kid. I also live very nearby a military base in Fort Smith, Arkansas. So the guard unit there in Fort Smith. So I used to watch airplanes take off from the field there, and it was always kind of inspiring to see them fly overhead. When I was a kid, I collected all the model airplanes. I had all the books. I used to study them. And I think, like most kids, most kids want to be a firefighter, an astronaut, a fighter pilot, or a police officer. And I just kind of clung on to the fighter pilot thing. And that's kind of how it started. And throughout my entire childhood, I just had that as a goal of something I've always wanted to do.
Did you have any mentors growing up that helped you to become a fighter pilot?
I didn't have any mentors who were fighter pilots who kind of helped me in that direction. But I would say my father was in the Navy Reserves. So he was a police officer and he also joined the Navy Reserves. And I guess what he, you know, kind of shaped in me was an appreciation for the military, for military service. And we got access to Navy bases when I was a kid, and I liked the culture of the military. So his influence, his mentorship kind of focused me on joining the military to pursue my aviation passion. So I would say he was probably the biggest influence in that regard.
Were you big into sports growing up?
Absolutely. I played sports all the time, baseball, wrestling, track, swimming, football. Really enjoyed the spirit of competition. I enjoyed working out, I enjoyed challenging myself and achieving things. So that was all something that I got a lot of satisfaction from. So, and to this day, I still enjoy that kind of stuff. I run competitively when I can and just enjoy that spirit of competition for sure.
What was it like to have that big dream of being a fighter pilot and turn it into a reality?
You know, it's It was neat. I can distinctly remember a point when I was driving on my way to Wichita Falls, Texas to go to UPT. And I was married at the time. I got married right after I joined the Academy, and saying to my wife, I can't believe I'm actually driving out to go fly airplanes for a living. So it was definitely a moment, a sense of achievement, even though at the beginning of UPT, it's the beginning of a long journey. But at that moment, I can remember how I was struck by the significance of where I had gotten to at that point in my life, and just excited for the opportunity to actually fulfill a lifelong dream at that point. So very exciting. And there definitely was that moment, that singular moment where it kind of hit me.
Are there any lessons that you learn achieving that dream that you've used since?
I think one of the big lessons learned, I would say, or just, words of wisdom, would be that there's a lot of things that could have happened that didn't allow me to achieve that dream. And I would say one thing I learned is that flying is great, but you don't necessarily have to become a pilot for that to define your identity. I think that would have been very disappointed if it didn't happen. But I think it's important to stay grounded while you're achieving these dreams. Use it to motivate you, use it to inspire you, use it to make you work hard, but don't get too wrapped up in it that it is your, that it becomes your only sole sense of identity. So I think back then, I was definitely into it and things worked out well. But I think as I've grown, I've become a little more grounded and realized that what you do for a living and what you do for work doesn't define who you are. Something there's more intrinsic characteristics about you that are shaped and molded through your life that really define who you are. And that's one thing that I think I would advise a young John Caldwell back in those days is, pursue your dreams, but realize, your character, who you are as a person is, and your identity shouldn't be wrapped up in just that.
So you've spent a lot of time deployed in combat. Can you talk about your first experience deploying?
Yeah, my first deployment was to Iraq in 2006 through 2007. It was kind of the darker period of time in that war. That's when Zarqawi was still running around, and there was a civil war that was starting, a lot of civilian casualties. The tide of the war had kind of turned against us. It looked pretty bleak at the time. I went there with my first fighter squadron, the Hounds of Heaven 524 out of Cannon Air Force Base, and I was a young flight lead. I just upgraded to a four-ship flight lead, and we were on our way out to Iraq, which up until that point was just something I saw in the news or things you heard people talking about. But it was different when you first get to that country and you're actually experiencing being in war for the first time, being in that country, seeing the people, seeing the land. And I remember it left quite an impression on me because as we were flying over, I realized that your whole life in training, everything is kind of been somewhat superficial in that you fight simulated wars, you drop simulated weapons, and here we were getting ready to go to another country. And everything was for real this time. And I think what struck me the most was, there's people who are literally maybe a quarter mile away from where I'm at right now who would love to end my life. And that was something that you had to deal with as a young person. Something I never thought about, that there are people out there who, if they could get their hands on you, they would kill you in a heartbeat. And we were living in close proximity to them. And then I was on the night train. I flew exclusively night missions for my time in Iraq. I didn't fly a single day sortie. It was all middle of the night flying missions. And it was a challenging time to fly on NVGs every single night, flying over blacked out cities. And so I really remember just how difficult it was to try to execute the job that I had mainly trained for in daylight my entire career, now executing at night with all the challenges that it presented itself. But I really enjoyed that first deployment. I think it really shaped me as a fighter pilot and as a person, because I had to, kind of figure out, how do I fit into this piece as a fighter pilot? What can I do to be better? And then just as a person in general, what are my thoughts on, not United States conducting war in other countries?
So what was the typical mission set that you're doing out there? Was it CAS?
We were typically doing CAS, and because of the time of day that I flew, I was normally supporting special operations forces as they were doing their mission. So it was a busy time of day to fly. There was definitely a lot of activity at night in Iraq. And during the daytime, it was a little bit quieter, and at night was where all the action was at. That's where a lot of the firefights were taking place. A lot of our action, U.S. action, was mainly occurring at night. So we were going out to support guys on the ground, moving into an objective, seizing whatever the objective is, and then withdrawing without loss of life and actually and capturing what it is that they're after. So I would support that, and it would typically involve me supporting that convoy in or a helicopter and whatever it may be, and then providing overwatch and then kinetic fire support if they need it.
So I want to talk a little bit about the night element. I had to fly on the night train while I was in Afghanistan, didn't see the day for 2 months, and I found it really challenging to go in and employ, and I had to strafe one time. We have a bridge here at Luke named after Trojan Gilbert, and I know our mutual friend Boris Kamensky was saying that he was in your squadron on that deployment. Can you talk a little bit about him and the mission that he was lost on?
Yeah, Trojan was a good friend. So he was here, or he was with us there in Iraq at Balad. General Rand had brought him out. He trained with us in the spin up on his pre-deployment training, because we knew he was going to be out there and flying with us. So he's attached to our unit. He flew in the Vol right prior when I would show up. So we'd always have overlap before I would step out to fly, as he was just finishing up. Great human being, real friendly. He would always take the time to ask you how your day's going. So I think everybody kind of made a real close personal connection with Trojan. Trojan's mission, you know, he was flying in a Vol that we typically didn't see a whole lot of action. It was one of the Vols that we deemed more benign, kind of safer. And it just so happens that we were conducting a special operations mission that nobody had really told us about. And things went south in a hurry just in the northwest side of Baghdad. And he was the closest two ship around to respond. So we ended up responding to that mission. It was a pretty bad firefight. And I think the survivability of friendlies on the ground was really at question at a point in that engagement. They were outgunned. They were outmaneuvered. The insurgents had technicals that are mobile. And then there was obviously an aircraft that got shot down in that whole piece. A little bird got shot down. So it was on the deck. It was wounded. And they knew that if they could just close the distance and get to the Americans, that was kind of the ultimate prize. So they were very aggressive with their tactics and trying to take out the Americans there because they saw an opportunity to win an IO battle, an information operations battle. So Cajun responded there, and he was conducting yo-yo ops with his wingmen, and the insurgents went mobile. They were trying to flank the friendly position using a couple technical vehicles, and they saw this from the ground happening, and they knew that they were going to have to engage. At the time, the best weapon we had to engage moving targets in the area they were at is the gun, to try at least deter the attack, try to prevent the attack, kill the enemy if able. And knowing what it was like back in those days, this is pre, you know, JHEMX, this is pre a lot of the stuff we have in the aircraft now, avionics wise. The only way to track a moving target is with the Mark I eyeballs. So I know, you know, Trojan was in the wheel, trying to keep a tally ho on the target, because he knew if he lost them, these guys were going to flank the friendlies. And he did a completely visual intercept for a strafe pass. And on one of the strafe pass, obviously got a little too steep and got a little slow and didn't have the energy to recover the aircraft. Knowing what he was processing at the time, I can completely see how that could happen. And, it was a really stressful situation. I heard the comms, I listened to the scenario, through the tapes of the aircraft that made it back. And it was an incredibly stressful situation that Trojan was in. And again, I think the Vol he was flying, they were kind of lulled in a sense of complacency. So it was, you know, no excitement. All of a sudden, your heart rate's going 180 beats per minute and trying to process what's going on the ground, and people are screaming for their lives. So when Trojan went in, it was a guard unit that took over the on-scene commander initially. And then me and my wingman were the next folks up. So we ended up flying the recovery effort for Trojan. By the time we got airborne and went over the crash site, and walking back a little bit there, I can remember getting a knock on my door that night, and it was our DO, and he said, "Hey, Brick, Trojan went down. He's either KIA or MIA. He's like, can you go fly? You're the next two ship that's going to be fragged to cover it." And we said, "Yeah, we're going to go fly," but we had to. It was kind of a gut check there because I knew Trojan well, and you know, it's. You compartmentalize quite a bit, but you know, seeing your buddies crash site on the ground, I knew it was going to affect you somehow. So you just had to think through that. But both me and my wingman decided that we're perfectly capable. This is what we're trained to do, and we'd like to go up there, and we want to be out there, you know, help them if there's any help to provide. So when we got overhead, the crash site still had not been secured. There were still tons of people around it. His body had been taken away from the crash site, unfortunately, so that piece was over. And our job was to escort the ground assault force that was going to try to move in to secure the site so they could start bringing in helos to start the investigation piece, the recovery piece, and all that. So we ended up spending about 6 hours there on the ground. And we got into multiple engagements because the convoy, as they were trying to make their way to the crash site, were engaged multiple times with IED attacks, ambushes, et cetera. So we ended up having to get involved there. And then getting back on the ground, I think the whole thing was just really surreal. But I think it really made me reflect on this is a serious business. And anytime you go strap one of these jets on and go to war, this is a possible outcome. And you have to be prepared to handle that. You have to accept that. So, you know, it really made me kind of think through that whole piece of you know, you may end up losing your life doing this job, and you have to be prepared to make that sacrifice like Trojan did.
How was the squadron able afterwards to balance the mission, grieving for him, and then also the well-being of the other pilots?
I think when people, I think a lot of people will do this when they're grieving. The best thing to do is to just get back into it and try to keep your mind engaged in the task at hand. I think that's what a lot of people did to cope. I'll be honest, there's some guys who I don't think fully recovered from that. His wingman that night, I don't think he fully recovered from it because there's a sense of guilt I think he had because he was not on scene when Trojan went in. He was at the tanker getting gas, so I know he carries around a bit of guilt that he could have done something. So different people dealt with in different ways. For me, I just focused on doing the mission. I just kind of got back to it and felt like that's what Trojan wants to do. That's what I would want guys to do is, you know, you can grieve. That's okay. But at the end of the day, let's just get back to it and do what you got to do because there's folks out there who are counting on us being 100% head in the game and being able to do what we got to do from the air. There's young kids on the ground dying every single day, both Americans and Iraqis, and we need to go out there and fly the mission. So I know for me and a lot of folks, it was, let's just bury ourselves back in our work. And that was a great way to just kind of move on and compartmentalize that.
I know here at Luke, he's still talked about highly. And at least when I was here back in 2011, we would all get together and have a moment of silence for him. So that's got to be tough. I've never lost a friend in a squadron, knock on wood, but I've definitely lost a fair number of other fighter pilots. So getting done with your Iraq deployment, what were some of the lessons that you learned that made you a better person and made you a better aviator?
So I think Iraq taught me a few things. One, it taught me to, I found in combat, you tend to make better decisions. You tend to be a little more cool, collected, calculating, more effective if you have a basic respect for your enemy, which I know sounds crazy, for some, you know, for the normal civilian populace to say, how can you respect it? You know, some of these folks with what they do. But what I found is once you kind of, you develop a somewhat of respect for they're doing what they're doing because they believe in it. And when I kind of accepted that and started thinking more, trying to get into the mind of the enemy, it made me a more effective fighter pilot that definitely paid off in Afghanistan. So what I found was it's important to not treat your targets on the ground as targets. They're human beings and they have motivations, fears, desires, pressures, all those things that we have. And a lot of times whenever I was analyzing my enemy, I would say, what would I do in this situation if I was on the ground? So I think whenever you dehumanize them or you treat them as inferior or you develop a disdain for them, you can discount the fact that they are highly intelligent people who are probably rational. They just have a different world perspective than you. And unfortunately, it's going to be the best man who wins. And that's the way that you just develop a respect that, hey, if it's your day, it's your day. And if it's my day, it's my day. And when you do that, it helps you deal with the fact that you may have to take life. You may have to take a lot of life on a certain mission. But the way that I always kind of dealt with that internally was I didn't do it out of malice. I never was aggressive with employing, with bravado or eagerness. It was never that way. It was always very much a very calculated in a respectful way. I'm sorry, but this is the way it's going to have to go. And that always helped me deal with, you know, that whole piece. But it also made me a better tactician as I learned that you really got to get inside the mind of the enemy. You got to get inside the mind of the people and you got to get inside the mind of the ground forces, the ground force commander. And once you truly appreciate and study and understand, the environments that they operate in and what their motivations are and what kind of people they are, you really develop a much better picture essay-wise on what's going on the ground, which can actually help you in the air. And from that, I think I was a much more effective and a much more capable fighter pilot in Afghanistan than I was in Iraq, because that was the big lesson learned that I got out of Iraq, is that if you can analyze what's going on in this combat zone from those lenses, you are a much more effective and capable fighter pilot and tactician. And there was definitely clear results of that mentality going forward. I was the weapons officer when we went to Afghanistan in the triple nickel. I was the squadron weapons officer. So not only did I develop, you know, this train of thought or this school of thought, I was able to actually encapsulate it and teach it and instruct it, and guys would apply it. So that was very rewarding. So I think our squadron was very in tune with what was going on, you know, with the enemy, with the ground forces, with the friendlies, and with the people. And it made us a very effective squadron up to that point, which was good because we were there at the peak of the troop surge in Afghanistan, and we were very busy out there. And I think we did a good job overall.
The triple nickel ripped us out, and I was able to fly one of their jets on my last mission. Can you talk a little bit about your deployment to Afghanistan? And you alluded to it, where we were strategically, and then what you guys were doing tactically.
Yeah, so this was in 2011. It was right after we had semi-declared victory in Iraq, and the shift was focusing back over to Afghanistan. We had kind of turned the tide in Iraq, and so they wanted to focus a lot of energy on Afghanistan and try to push the Taliban out. I think back then we really thought we could control the major city areas, control the rural areas, and push out the Taliban. And so we were doing a lot of movement to contact missions. It was the highest peak of troops in the entire war. I think it was around 110, 140,000, somewhere in there. So it was the highest concentration of troops we had. Most active period of time of the war in 2011. And again, there was a sense that if we can get out, conduct missions, push out the Taliban, clear and hold, that we would eventually be able to kind of, you know, through ink blots, slowly spread American influence and Afghan influence as we build up the Afghan capability. So I would say that ground force commanders were pretty aggressive in 2011. They were going outside the wire almost every day in an effort to try and take back some ground from Taliban. We had a lot of special forces missions going on in the evening time and in the daylight. So overall, it was kind of the way I looked at it, it was one of our last final big push to try and clear things out. And I was out there from March of 2011 until November of 2011. So for pretty much the entire year, 2011 was spent in Afghanistan. And so we went out there. We had just got some new weapons. The GBU-54 is brand new. It just really coming into swing. And we developed some new TTPs with that weapon to engage some pretty tricky targets that used collateral damage kind of as their shield. So, very active squadron, very busy. And we were mainly covering down on RC East, which was one of the more busy RCs, regional areas in Afghanistan. RC Southwest was also busy, but we were up in RC East where the terrain was just so unforgiving. You have mountains that go up to 20,000 feet, Konar River Valley, Lone Survivor, you know, all those things, all those movies were made in that area. So it was very, very tough enemy out there, very hardened. They had fended off the Russians in the 80s. They still had their weapons caches. So a lot of places to hide things, a lot of places to stage attacks. And again, they're very aggressive. So it was a very tough time to be in Afghanistan. And as a result, it was a very kinetic time to be in Afghanistan.
I read you received the Distinguished Flying Cross, which is heroism or extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight. Can you talk about that mission?
That was a mission that was up in Bajmetal. It was an area in the north, very north part of the Konar River Valley. Bajmetal is a incredibly tough place to hold ground or conduct missions because the terrain is so unforgiving. Very steep rise to the cliffs, very narrow valleys, lots of insurgents. And it was a funnel point for weapons. As most people know, weapons would be funneled in from various places. They would kind of start from the north and work their way south through the Konar. So there was a mission that was being executed in that area. And I can't, you know, the missions are still classified, so I can't speak to the exact details of who, what, where, when, and why. But the overall mission was we had friendlies on the ground who were conducting a clearing operation. And when I got onto scene, it was again, right as sun was setting. And I think I would say there was inadequate support based off of the amount of resistance that they encountered by the time I got up there. And it was apparent to me in the air as the sun went down, the enemy waited for the exact moment, went to time their attack that would inflict the most damage. So it was just me and my wingman. It was a two ship overhead, and this one particular team was being attacked, and they're being attacked in what I would call a complex coordinated attack. So you had multiple elements of mortar fire, heavy machine gun, RPGs, light machine guns, and they had essentially set up a kill zone because they had all day to, I think, plan out what they were going to do. So when that happened, it was a pretty dire moment on the ground. The friendlies took casualties immediately, and that kind of put them in a defensive crouch, and they really didn't have a whole lot of organic firepower to return or defend their position. So they were essentially reliant on Cass and us overhead. So fortunately, you know, long story short, there's a point where the insurgents tried to completely overrun the friendly position. They made two big pushes with probably, you know, by the folks on the ground count, over 100 people rushing their position. I was the only person on scene at the time, and very rapidly had to employ a series of ordnance to, not only stop the attack, but reverse the attack. I think what got noticed in that sortie is what I'll assume. I mean, you have a lot of stories that are like this, but I think what was noticed there was a lot of coordination that I was trying to do on behalf of these soldiers on the ground. They didn't really have any good advocates for them. So I was trying to advocate to the ground force commander back at the talk, to the ASOC to get more assets overhead, to have more helicopter support, medevac support. So it's in between trying to employ ordnance, keep people calm on the ground, engage the enemy. It was constant on the radios, on SATCOM, talking to their leadership and trying to communicate how dire the situation was, to the point where we declared a mass cast to really get things going. To our system's credit, eventually the assets started funneling in. And I'm a FACA. I was a FACA then, FACA instructor. So I started controlling them in the stack and started using their sensors, doing a sensor sort plan, trying to do the best we can to maximize our firepower to prevent these guys from getting overrun. So I think that just that coordination piece of thinking outside your cockpit is probably what got a lot of folks' attention. Unfortunately, we were able to, we could have lost a lot more folks, and we didn't, which was good. Unfortunately, not everybody walked out of that valley or got helicoptered out of the valley. But I think given the circumstances, we were lucky that we didn't have more casualties on our hand.
And leaving Afghanistan, was there anything that you learned there that you hadn't learned in your deployment to Iraq?
Yeah, I think that's where I really understand the importance of developing a relationship with the personnel on the ground. When I was in Iraq, I always just kind of assumed that the job of the Air Force is to show up. We check in with the JTAC, we get our line, you know, we conduct an attack and we move on. I guess I didn't, because the Army is so big, it's such a machine, there's no room for personal relationships or contacts. What I found in Afghanistan is that trust is a huge part of combat, particularly in the CAS world. Trust is a huge deal. And I developed relationships with particular battalion commanders, and I found that these folks would be more willing to engage targets that need to be engaged if they knew we were overhead with our call sign than other folks, or they would request us specifically. And the reason why that's important is because these are targets that needed to be engaged. Just the risk versus reward, that balance was all in check if they knew we were overhead because they trust our operations. And with other folks, they may not have that same level of trust that they're going to do the right thing or execute the attack the way they say they're going to. So we made great efforts to improve our relationship with all of the with all our ground folks in Afghanistan. When I was out there, we started an LNO program where I sent my pilots out to battlefield talks, battalion talks. I've sent pilots out into the Konar River Valley, and they're in the jock walking around with sergeant majors and the battalion commanders and the sevens and the sixes. And we gained a pretty good reputation with the Army guys and developed pretty close relationships with them. And it just made us so much more effective whenever they checked in, they heard our voice and we were a familiar squadron. They trusted us and they knew us. It really just enabled some things that we wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. Never did that in Iraq. It was something I really learned in Afghanistan, that for relationships matters, trust matters, and that battalion commanders are people and they have different risk calculus. And you can help them if you understand them. You can help them sort through the fog and friction of making a kinetic decision if you understand that guy's situation and what he's concerned about or what he's stressed about. And I think that was something we did really well, was we were able to get inside the mind of that ground force commander and really kind of analyze what his stress and pressures are and come up with the, offer a good game plan to him, solution. And then there was that element of mutual trust, that they knew who we were and they trust us, and that's how we executed it.
So I want to talk a little bit about what you were doing before your current job. So you were out of Eglin doing the test and evaluation job. What was that like, kind of being on the cutting edge using some of the new stuff coming down the pipeline?
It was very rewarding. I think all the experiences that I had in combat really helped prepare me for that job, because I kind of just had, I had fresh data of what it was like to be in combat. I kind of knew where the tactical deficiencies were at. I knew where our avionics deficiencies were at least for that particular mission set. And it was very gratifying to be able to go in and affect how the aircraft operates, the software we get, the hardware we get, the tactics that we employ. The assignment, originally I selected that assignment because I'm from Florida and it was at Eglin Air Force Base. It was the closest thing to home. And I'd spent a lot of time deployed, TDY or deployed. And, we thought this would be a good family assignment to live on the beach and be close to Orlando and visit. So that was kind of the first reason. But then because I really didn't understand what OT did until I got into it. I knew they did test stuff, but that was kind of the extent of it. But one thing I really liked about the squadron is that the squadron was made of a bunch of more experienced pilots. They had a large number of weapons officers, folks who had over 1,500 hours in the jet as kind of a bare minimum. Everybody was an instructor in the platform they flew in. And I was in a multi-MDS squadron, the 85th. It was F-15C, F-15E, and F-16, which was really neat. So I got to see different communities, and we all lived in the same vault. We flew mixed lines, integrated lines. So you would take off and you would have two Vipers and two Eagles. That's your four ship. So I enjoyed that aspect of just, broadening my perspective, broadening the horizons on the other MDSs that are out there and appreciating their culture and what they've done to develop their MDSs. But specifically developing new technology and being on the leading edge, I liked being the conduit between military industry and the warfighter, because we would get to go and engage with the people who are setting requirements, to the people who are building the equipment, and speak on behalf of the warfighter and represent them. And that was incredibly rewarding. And then to go out and test it and see the thing that you have put into the OFP or put into the suite, or the increment, whatever you want to call it, come to fruition. And then you get to take it on the road and teach guys how to use it and, the thought process behind it. It made me a better pilot, I think, because you really have to kind of go back to the basics and the fundamentals of different mission sets to see where we can improve the aircraft or the tactics in order to make it happen.
What's the process like to kind of triage all that equipment coming in and figuring out what's a nice to have and what's a need to have?
So we go through a pretty lengthy process where we will we'll invite the initial meeting. Called an ASARC is when we say, hey, we're going to develop a new series for the F-16, new software. And every MDS does this. So it can be, suites for the strikes and the Eagles, whatever it may be. We invite everybody to go to this meeting, and it's where we do an initial, here's some good ideas that came from the CAF. Now we invite everybody, but typically when we go to these ASARCs, it was only OT guys. And maybe like one other guy from the CAF who got the word, just because it's such a bizarre thing. But they'd go there and they would throw down an initial list of ideas. And it's just any good idea you have, throw it on the list and we'll start thinking about it and prioritize it. Now, it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be something that is, that is technically feasible based off of current state of technology. So you can't ask for laser beams. Mm-hmm. But you can within reason, if it's something that can be done. Engineering wise, scientifically, then it's a player. So after that, we go into our MCRTs. MCRTs are very much focused on, okay, now that we got the list of what everybody wants, we'll cut it down to what we think the top candidates are. And now we're going to give you an estimate of cost of money. What's it going to cost to do this? Because you may have 70 good ideas, but if you want to execute idea number 10, then that's all you can execute because of cost. So now we have to get into a prioritization kind of battle of what's most important. Where can we compromise? Would you rather not do number 5 so you can get 15 through 25, or would you rather just do number 5 and cut out those other ones? That goes into, and we do multiple MCRTs, and those are typically, those are only OT guys and the people who program the aircraft, which right now for the F-16 is at Ogden. When I first got on, it was still at Lockheed. Lockheed owned the OFP, but that's no longer the case. And then from there, we slowly whittle it down to what are the best candidates. And this is where we try in OT to look forward, look into the future as much as possible. Because everybody kind of, everybody has their darlings, the things that they're really attached to or what they would like to see in the jet. And we were very, we tried to impress upon all of our OT guys and people who go to these MSARCs and ACRTs that you are not there to make the Viper the way you want it to be. You are there to look into the future to say, what will make the Viper a competitive platform in the environment it's intended to be used? How will it complement the force, and what does it need to be good at to fight the next war? And we try not to drive competition between MDSs. We try to find a way we can complement the force so that when you force package and you put Vipers in with F-35s, we're not trying to do the same thing the F-35's doing. We're trying to do something that's complementary to what they do so that we can fight together better. And so that was the way we would always kind of look at these things. Now, a lot of this stuff is minor, but the overall mentality was how can we shape the F-16 to be a viable combat platform in the future in an integrated fight? And that was kind of our tagline and motto. And nobody told us to do that. That was just instinctively what we decided to do. So we would oftentimes, you know, try to get insights from senior leaders on, hey, how do you envision F-16s being employed? And unfortunately, what we found is we have to develop a capability, and that makes us marketable. And then you get put into a plan to use that capability instead of the other way around a lot of times. So we would try to, again, try to find things that made us unique, made us desirable, made it complement the force, and therefore, you know, kind of improve the longevity and likelihood of that aircraft staying around and being desirable.
And so this is Air Force wide, because I don't think any other plane has been able to age as well as the F-16 from back in the days of dogfighting with the AIM-9 Papas to, you know, doing CAS and SEED now. Is that the reason why it's been able to age so well?
You know, I can't speak to its, you know, how it's kind of evolved compared to the other MDSs. I know for us, I would say that, yes, I think the reason why the Viper stays viable and stays marketable is because we are not looking to compete. We are looking to augment, supplement, to be complementary in the force. So I think there was a time where OFPs were developed where, you know, if they're going to have this mission set, well, we want to have the same thing. If they're going to do this, then we want to do that. So I think that's been helpful in the fact that we've done that. I mean, for example, we do SEED quite a bit. We've really focused the OFP on handling the SEED mission because that's one area that we can definitely complement the force for folks. There's some folks who don't have quite the SEED game that we have, and so we're a good complementary force. Now, I would also say that the F-16 is not, it's a cheaper platform. I'll just say it's a cheaper platform than a lot of the other MDSs out there. So we can get away with doing some experiments. It doesn't cost quite as much as other aircraft. And it's a cheaper airplane to modify overall. So that's another thing that we win often, is that we will get new equipment or we'll get new stuff because we will run the risk reduction for a bigger program. For example, auto GCAS. We got that. You know, the Viper needed it, but I would argue a big part of it.
Can you describe that for people who don't know?
Sure. Yeah, auto GCAS, it's an algorithm that's continually running in the aircraft that prevents CFIT, essentially. The aircraft is designed to auto-recover itself if you're going to go within certain tolerances of the ground, and it doesn't detect a pilot input. So it's on continually when we put the gear up, and it stays on until we put the gear back down. So what it will do is that it has a digital database, a very high-fidelity digital database that's running a computer program, an algorithm of an aircraft flying over the ground that you're flying over. And if it predicts that you're going to collide at any point, then the jet will take control of the aircraft and recover you so that you don't impact the ground. So the example is, the classic example is a G-lock on a BFM set. Whereas in the past, we've had folks who go to the turn circle entry, they pull back on the stick, they G-lock, and if they don't wake up in time, they're going to hit the ground. With auto GCAS now, if you G-lock, the aircraft will sense that you're not going to recover in time to recover above the ground, and it'll recover the aircraft for you and keep you flying level above the ground until you can wake up and get your wits about you. And it'll continue to recover you if if you're pointing at the ground and it recovers and there's a mountain in front of you, it will pull up in front of the mountain. It'll continue to recover you so you don't hit the ground. The only thing it doesn't do is move your throttles, so you could run out of airspeed at some point. But it's a fantastic system. It's already saved lives. And it was new, and we had to test it fully to see if I'm fighting BFM or if I'm doing a strafe run. It's not going to try to take the jet over when I do something aggressive that I'm intentionally doing aggressive. So we had to do a lot of the testing on that. And the algorithms are continually being refined to make it a better system. And then eventually it's going to get transported into F-22 and F-35. But that's one example of F-16. We're doing risk reduction for a lot of other platforms. And once we get it down perfect, it'll get moved on to other aircraft. But in general, the F-16 has stayed viable and stayed alive because we get these new capabilities, because we are, in general, a cheaper platform to work with and a good tech demo for a lot of the stuff. And then we get to retain it. And that's kind of kept the F-16 going.
I've seen some of those auto GCAS recoveries, and it's been incredible seeing, a pilot going Mach 1 at the ground and then being able to see the system pull up and save their life.
Yeah. And it also is associated. It also came with a PARS button, the pilot activated recovery system, which is what we call the spatial D button. So in addition to having the auto GCAS recovery system, we now have a button in the F-16 that any point I'm spatially D'd, I can tell the jet to do the thing, which is recover me to straight level flight, and it'll do it for you. So it's that's a nice thing to have in the aircraft. It just helps with confidence in the weather, because some folks have gone out of control or have needed that button, and it's there for us now. Where if you ever feel like you don't know which way's up and down and everything's spinning around in a hurry, you just hit that button and it'll snap you back to wings level in a couple seconds.
It sounds like up to this point in your career, you've been heavy on the tactics, and you transitioned to joining the Thunderbirds. What kind of made that shift to switch to the other side of the pendulum?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you're right. So I've really, on the tactic side, did the weapons officer act, went to test and evaluation. I was the weapons officer there, was the division commander for F-16. We did a lot of tactics development there, kind of helping with the Viper evolution. And I kind of just thought that was my lot in life, to be honest with you. I figured that's where the Air Force has invested all of its money. That's where it's invested all its time in me, is to develop me to go down this track. And I just kind of saw that as my destiny, to kind of continue down that tactics, gray jet, weapons officer role. So I really never thought about the Thunderbirds. I just I always knew they were there. I always appreciated their mission. I thought it was exciting and cool, but I just never thought it was something that I would be able to do, to be quite honest with you. And I was the DO, I became the director of operations in the 85th, the squadron that I was I was in the 85th, and then went to school and then came back to be the director of operations of the 85th. And then I actually took over a squadron command at Eglin, the 28th Session Evaluation Squadron. And I was a squadron commander for an entire year. So you could tell that the Thunderbirds are kind of, that was a pretty distant thought for me, because I was marching on to finishing command and then going to school. I was a school select and got selected for SDE. So I was on my way to school, continue with my career. And then it was really my wing commander at Eglin who mentioned that there's an opportunity for you to apply for the Thunderbirds. And he wanted to know if I was interested. He thought I would be a good fit. And it really caught me off guard, because I was like, "Hey boss, I'm over a year into command, and, you want me to start over?" And so, initially after I started thinking about it, so it was really my wing commander who provided the opportunity, just because I never thought it was a possibility for me. And so I went home, I talked to my wife, and after talking to her about it, I realized that I would, I'd love to do the mission. And there is a career impact, because I was already a squadron commander and moving on to go to school. It was going to impact my timeline for going to SDE and group commanding. And I'm sure you're aware of all the timeline requirements if you want to continue mm-hmm. on your Air Force career. So this is going to hit me pretty hard there, because I essentially would have to start, I'd be 2 years behind the rest of my peer group. So we talked about it, and I decided that, But this is something I really want to do. And career stuff, I'm not going to really concern myself too much with it. I'm not kind of a careerist kind of guy. So I just wanted to, if it's an opportunity that I want to do and people are asking me about it, then I'm going to take advantage of it. So I was given the opportunity to apply by my wing commander because he had to release me from command if I got selected, which he had expressed the intent that he would if I got selected. So the Thunderbirds, why do I want to join the Thunderbirds? I always was impressed with the precision of that mission. I had a chance to watch your demo a couple times and listen to the comms, and it was just such bizarre flying to me, listen to the communication and looking at what those guys do, that I immediately wanted to do it. It just looks so challenging, and I really appreciate challenges like that. So it was a completely different way of flying the F-16 that I had never even seen or heard. And that kind of, that motivated me, excited me. In addition to that, I really appreciate and like the Thunderbird mission. I think it's a valid mission. I think it's absolutely necessary. And I have taken advantage of the Thunderbird mission, selfishly, when I was just a regular CAF weapons officer kind of guy, because I would take my family to air shows, they would see the Thunderbirds perform and you'd see the crowds and they're just at awe with the incredible power of the machines. They are amazed at how close people fly, just the precision of the pilots. You know, the sneak pass comes by and it scares the living daylights out of everybody. And so I used to tell my family, my friends, I said, yeah, take a look at this demo and it's impressive. Imagine if we took all this skill, all this technology and all the power of these machines, and we completely dedicated it and devoted it to stopping you with what you're trying to do. That was such a meaningful thing for me to try to get my family an idea of what I do in the gray jet world. Here, you guys got a glimpse. Yeah. You see these guys doing loops, doing loops and barrel rolls and those kind of things, and you're impressed. Well, we do the same exact level of detail. We employ the same amount of incredible technology. And we're doing the same thing, except we're dedicating it towards stopping somebody from doing something. And that was, it was kind of a neat way to relate the Thunderbird mission to what I did. And it helped get me some points with the family, of course. But I think that mission is important, of instilling public confidence in our military, of showing the pride and precision of the United States Air Force. And then, really in the whole team concept too, the maintainers, the PA folks, the back shop support, just everything coming together to execute that mission really highlights the Air Force in a positive way. And that was exciting to me. And I really wanted to do it. So I applied, and I went through the selection process just like everybody else. I competed. And fortunately at the end of the day, they selected me, and the rest is history, I guess.
How's the transition been? Has it been pretty tough to go from the tactics world to the Thunderbird world?
I think there's some things. So flying the demo is definitely challenging. It takes a lot of training. Our syllabus is over 100 sorties long before you graduate the syllabus. And it's that long for a reason. There's no fat in there. So there are some things that are definitely different, but there's a lot of things that are the same. And that is, at the end of the day, you need to exercise flight leadership and dynamic flight leadership. So not only do you need to have a solid understanding, good game plan going out the door, but you need to be able to analyze what's going on, make calls in the air. And I think all that is part of what we do as fighter pilots in the CAF, is that we blast with a plan, we try to execute it, but inevitably something's going to be different, wrong, or change. And we have to be able to think and fly and execute at the same time, which can be challenging for some folks. And this job demands that as well. Same thing. So using the human processor to analyze the changing sight picture and make the best decision and then going from there. This team demands that just as much as any other squadron. By the way, as Thunderbird 1, I lead every single mission. I lead every single cross country, and I fly roughly 8 to 10 times a week. So just being a good, just having good flight leadership is important, which that was all developed in my time leading up to this job. Because we do a lot of flying. But the flying piece itself, flying and learning the demo. That's pretty different. That takes some getting used to, because most of the time we don't spend a whole lot of time in close formation, and the way they have to fly the aircraft and the way they have to sync it with communications and turning smoke on and all that is very, very challenging. It's very difficult to do it right. Your brain is just not trained when you show up to this squadron to do that instinctively. You have to develop the muscle memory and the habit patterns. And the flying is incredibly unforgiving. I mean, if I'm in, even in a reposition, if I'm even 0.1 G's different, or if I maneuver, you know, and I have a 0.1 change, the guys will sense it and they'll know it. So I have to fly almost like a robot. It's very smooth, very methodical, you know, and it's, and you got guys 18 inches off your wing, not just straight and level, but in the vertical rolling, you know, loops, clover loops, they're right there 18 inches off your wing as you're transitioning through wind shear, turbulence, everything else. So flying that smoothly and that precisely is incredibly difficult, incredibly challenging. But at the end of the day, I really do enjoy the challenge.
Yeah. What's that like being not only the squadron commander, being the coach, but also being a skill player? I don't think there's anywhere else in the Air Force where the squadron commander has to be the guy on the line flying every day.
Yeah. You know, I don't know the statistics for sure, but I'd probably argue I'm one of the higher flying squadron commanders just based off this job. And that definitely makes my life busy. We work 6 days a week. I get one day off a week, and really that one day off I'm working. And that's just the nature of the job. I talked to my wife before we took this assignment, because this is, you have to have your family support on this, because it just demands so much from you, in terms of time, you know, personally, professionally, it just demands so much from you that it's got to be a family decision. And we knew that these 2 years that I was going to be the commander leader, we almost had to treat it like it was a deployment, that I'm going to be completely consumed with this job. And so with the support of the family, we've mentally prepared ourselves for that. But to answer your question, I mean, I have a commander support staff, but at the end of the day, you know, they help quite a bit. But at the end of the day, I'm still the squadron commander. So I'm still, you know, signing EPRs, going to EFDPs, taking care of squadron discipline, trying to set people up for success, doing school pushes, mentoring. I mean, you name it. It's all the squadron commander stuff that you have to do. And I don't, you know, I just have to find time in my day. So I show up really early and I stay really late. I'm essentially a 12 hour kind of guy every single day. And then I'm on top of that flying at least once and sometimes twice a day. So it just becomes exhausting. But to answer your question, very busy. And I can say that because I was a squadron commander at Eglin, and I spent the majority of my time just doing squadron command, because that's kind of where your priority needs to be. Flying maybe 4 or 5 times a month. Well, here, the demo is incredibly challenging to fly. I have to dedicate time and attention to flying it well, because it's the most visible piece of what we do. And so it definitely has to be safe and it has to be effective. So I've dedicated a large amount of time to flying, and then the commander stuff I have to fill in where I have the time. And that typically is, you know, on the weekends, it's early in the morning or late at night, but yeah, it can be draining at time, no doubt.
So what's the routine like once you guys are on the road?
A normal routine is we'll have an air show on the weekend. So the way that typically starts is, we'll start with Wednesday. So Wednesday is the day off for the folks who are traveling on the road, which we have 135-ish people on the team, and 60 will travel at any given show site. So we have a home crew and a road crew. Obviously, all the officers, so 1 through 12 go to every single show. So our show center folks, they will go on every single show as well. So on Wednesday, the road crew will have the day off. However, our number 8, who is our advanced pilot and narrator, will take off cross country that morning and fly to the location that we're going to do the air show at and bed down and set up initial operations there, which is pretty amazing to watch. Actually, this squadron has really learned how to do this in the most efficient way possible. So he's out on Wednesday. So I'm typically keeping tabs on that and seeing how things are going on Wednesday, which is the one day off we get. Thursday morning, we show up and we will brief and fly cross country to wherever is we're going. We'll have a C-17 typically supporting the all the maintainers and support officers and all the equipment that we have to bring. And then the pilots 1 through 7. So 1 through 6 being in the demo, 7 being my second command, my DO, we will all go cross country together to fly into the location that we're going to be doing the air show at. When we arrive on station, we typically will have a tanker, or we'll get enough gas on our hops to have enough fuel to do what we call a site survey. And the site survey is essentially a non-aerobatic demo. It's a chance for us to run the lines, take a look at the hazards associated with the TFR, towers, birds, rising, falling terrain, visual illusions, things like that. So we're constantly, you know, looking at the TFR to try to get as much SA as we can on it. And then we'll land after that. And then we will go into our debrief, and then we'll go into our, whatever our night activity is. It could be a PR, it could be a public relations event, or it could be free time or dinner with other folks. So it just depends, but it's typically a pretty busy day, depending on where the cross country is going to. Meanwhile, after we land, we'll be doing fan flights and media flights, for hometown heroes, people in the area, who are notable. And then on Friday, we will wake up. We typically do school visits in the morning or recruiting trips or some type of PR event in the morning. And then we show up to the squadron for the brief for the practice. We do a practice on Friday, which is typically a special needs air show. So we meet with our special guests, interact with them. We'll also do an enlistment that day and then fly the demo. We'll come back and meet with guests after the show is over and then go right to the debrief. From the debrief, we go typically into another PR public relations event on Friday, and that'll take you till about 8 o'clock. So pretty full day. Saturday morning is really where we only have our free time. So Saturday between when you wake up and we have to go into the brief is for the most part, you know, up until about 11 is free time. And then at 11, we're doing recruiting booth visits out on the flight line. And then we go in for the brief, fly the actual air show on Saturday, debrief. Saturday night is typically off. We normally get done with debriefing around 7 o'clock at night. And then Sunday we'll show up in the morning for a bunch of meetings. So a debrief on how the show site went, and we brief for the next mission, the next show site we're going to go to. Sunday, conduct the air show, land, and then Sunday night's off to prep for the cross country on Monday. Monday we go cross country back home, and a lot of times we'll turn into a training mission the second go if we need to get some training done. So we work a full day on Monday. We go home. Tuesday is a full training day, which we typically fly twice in that day. And then Wednesday's our day off, and we repeat.
Sounds busy. My head's spinning. Let's anchor on the debrief a little bit.
Sure.
What's the debrief like? Are you leading every single one of them?
Yes, I lead every brief and every debrief. And so I would say that this squadron is very much a fighter squadron, and the fact that we take our debrief culture very seriously. So we look at every single maneuver. We listen to every single radio call. I think whenever people come and watch us debrief, they're amazed at two things. One, the level of detail that we drive down to in our debriefs, and two, the efficiency of it, just how quickly we can process so much data and get to our DFPs and lessons learned very rapidly. And yes, we still develop DFPs and we still do lessons learned at the end of each brief. Everybody has... So I'll do that overall for the team, and then everybody has the individual objectives that we're shooting for that day. A lot of the stuff that we focus on is things that probably would never be noticed by the crowd, to be quite honest with you, but we still take the time to make sure that the show is perfect in every aspect that we can make it perfect. So we will cover in excruciating. We even cover, you know, the portion of us walking out from the briefing room to the tent, to the jets. We even debrief how that went. So we debrief literally everything. And these are not, you know, we're shooting the wristwatch kind of thing, high fiving each other and calling a night. We have videotape of everything we've done. We watch through it and watch the critical motions, watch the ground show, watch the takeoffs, watch every single maneuver, critique it, grade it, debrief it. And then we get a grade sheet on every single, most people probably don't realize this, but we get a grade sheet on every single air show we do. The grade sheet goes all the way up to COMAC. So we take, you know, the tape review, the debrief very seriously, because all that data goes into the grade sheet, and that gets sent up to our senior leaders for their review.
So what are you looking forward to most this season?
You know, what I'm looking forward to is, I think we have a good team right now. We're still pretty young. We're, you know, things are still kind of fragile. I mean, the demo is very safe. It looks very good. But I think we're capable of being a really remarkable team. I really enjoyed seeing, and not just on the demo side of the house, but across the officers and across the enlisted force with maintenance and the support and support shop. I'm really looking forward to seeing the team gel and get better at doing this and becoming more and more proficient at it. I think we're poised to have a really good season. I've really enjoyed just seeing us get continually better and better and better. That's really been, it's been motivating, to be quite honest with you, to want to continue to work hard when you see that all this hard work is not going to vain. It's actually, guys are taking feedback, they're working harder, and we're making progress of becoming a really great team, I think. So I'm really looking forward to see this team evolve from being, you know, a bunch of pedestrians into a, you know, one of the, an outstanding demo team and by Thunderbird standards, an outstanding demo team. Just watching that evolution and being with the guys through that, that I'm excited about that. I'm also looking forward to just the interactions. I think this is a unique position, and I realize that when people interact with me, when they see me, they see Thunderbird One. Not necessarily John Caldwell, but I enjoy the interactions. I realize I'm a steward of this position, so I do the best I can to pay tribute to that and make sure that I'm diligent for my time on watch. But I do really enjoy interacting with people, and just by your interaction, you made a positive influence on them. That was a positive experience. So every show side I go to, people are really excited to meet Thunderbird One, and that's really cool. And it's just a really neat feeling. So the interactions with people and being able to meet and discuss and chat with folks, that's been really motivating, and I'm really looking forward to continuing doing that. We've got some cool venues coming up. On a more mundane note, I'm looking forward to going to Colombia. The team hasn't been to Colombia since the 60s, and that should be an interesting trip. So we're going to Medellin, Colombia. And I think that crowd is going to be really, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I want to put on a good demo for those guys. And I want them to, I want the team to enjoy the experience down there. And I think it's great for the relations between our two countries, and really, really looking forward to that trip. I think that's going to be a unique life experience. I think it's going to be a unique Thunderbird experience also.
And where can people follow you and the team and see the schedule?
So we have a website, afthunderbirds.com is the best place to go to get up to date information. It's a .com. So it's a commercial site that graciously Lockheed pays for us to maintain. So that's how we got away with that one in the Air Force. But we put all of our up to date information in terms of teams, the schedules there. We're also on Instagram. We're also on Facebook. Those are all good places to go if you want to get up to date information on what the team is doing, where we're at. We post a lot of fun videos on Instagram and Facebook as well. So all the things we've done this year, the Super Bowl flyover, Captain Marvel, Daytona 500, Las Vegas Motor Speedway, all the air shows we've done as well. We typically will give some kind of update or something, which typically includes a video or a story for people to kind of take a look at. We just got the 360 camera that we've started to put into our jets, and we experimented with that on the Super Bowl flyover, and we put out a 360 camera from my number 4's jet, where people can put on VR headsets and be in the cockpit with us. And that's gotten a lot of positive response. So all that stuff, you can find that on the Facebook, social media side of the house, Instagram, but afthunderbirds.com is a good place to go to if you just want to get basic information about the team.
Awesome. Brick, well, thanks for taking time out of your day to do the interview, and I look forward to catching a show this year.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Hazard. It was great chatting with you.
If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to review it. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.